history of suffering and the sovereignty of God. And this week we're thinking about the reasons for suffering. Last week we looked at some of the responses to suffering, and this week we're looking at the reasons for suffering. And I've got some questions again to start with, like I did last week. What is the reason why there's so much suffering in our world today? Are there different reasons? If so, what are those reasons for why people suffer? Why does God allow it? There can be a mindset in Christian circles, especially in the West, that if we are following God and trusting in Him, then only good things will happen to us. Last week, we looked at Job's response to this kind of thinking when his wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Why don't you just curse God and die?" And his response was, "You're foolish, woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" Chapter 3 through to chapter 32 of the book of Job records a series of conversations between Job and his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, around this important theme of why a person is suffering. You remember they turned up at the end of chapter 2 last week, and they just were present with Job and his suffering. They were doing a good thing as friends. They didn't say a word. There was not much they could say. They just sat there. They saw his distress. They saw his pain, and they literally just were silent with him, but made their presence known to him. But as the presence continues, Job begins to pour out his heart, begins to pour out his confusion. He begins to ask the questions of why. And he begins to say, "Lord, I wish I had died at birth. Why was I ever born?" And their response to that is the following conversations, and it goes backwards and forwards between these three friends and Job. Job constantly defending his innocence, as it were. But, of course, chapter 3 to chapter 32 is quite a few chapters, and you'll be pleased to know that we're not going to read all those this morning. But I wanted to take just a couple of observations from each one of the friends and just share what their thoughts were and what was happening to Job. So this was Eliphaz's observation. He made this kind of summary, this comment. He said, "The innocent do not suffer, but the wicked do." So when he's talking to Job in chapter 4, verse 7, he says, "Consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? When were the upright ever destroyed?" Job's saying he's innocent, but he's saying, "But consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? When were the upright ever destroyed?" In verse 15, verse 20, he says, "All his days the wicked man suffers torment." Bildad's observation is this. He says, "Job, you must have sinned," is pretty much summing it up. In chapter 8, verse 20, he says, "Surely God does not reject a blameless man or strengthen the hands of evildoers." Chapter 18, verse 5, it says, "The lamp of the wicked is snuffed out." So far, his observations and his accusations are this: you know, the guilty are always punished. So, Job, you must be guilty. In chapter 11, verse 11, he says, "Surely God recognizes deceitful men. And when he sees evil, does he not take note?" Chapter 20, verse 23, "When the evil man has filled his belly, God will vent his burning anger against him and rain down blows upon him." Nice, comforting words that his friends give to Job in response to Job's plight that he is innocent. His words are saying, "Oh, I haven't done anything." So the summary of the three friends of Job is this: a God who is just plus a person who is suffering equals clear proof of sin. A God who is just plus a person who isn't suffering equals clear proof of virtue. Or put it like this, people who do evil plus a loving and powerful God equals people who are cursed. Or people who do good plus a loving, powerful God equals people who are blessed. That was basically what they were saying right through from chapter 3 right through to chapter 32 in all their dialogues. That is summarizing everything that they have said about Job's situation. Now, some of what Job's friends say seems to make sense. Much of what they say is repeated in other places in the scriptures. However, we know from what God says about Job that he is his servant and he is without fault. Do you remember what God said about Job in verse 8 of chapter 1? He said, there is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. That's God speaking about Job. And yet, Job is experiencing all this tragedy. But the innocent do not suffer, declares Eliezer, so therefore you must be guilty. The innocent do not suffer. But sometimes they do. Wars, famines, abuse, miscarriages of justice. Think how many people, innocent people, have been affected and suffered because of wars. That was not their doing. Because of natural disasters, because of famines, because of abuse, mental, emotionally, physical, spiritual. And miscarriages of justice, people in prison for things that they had never done. When I was first a Christian, I remember reading a book called Killing Time about an ex-policeman who was sent to prison for 7 years for a murder he didn't commit. And maybe you've read that book too, or you've heard him speak, but an incredible testimony. We know that there are many, many people in prison today who are innocent of the charges against them. So the innocent do suffer. We also know what God says to Eliphaz and his friends at the end of the story, in Job 42. He says, I'm angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken to me what is right like my servant Job has. You see, we see the friends of Job made a number of observations and accusations against him. They came to the wrong conclusion, assuming suffering is always a sign of a person's sin or God's displeasure with a person. They wrongly assumed God was not present in a person's suffering. They see suffering and sorrow as a sign that God has removed himself from a person because of their sin. Now, it's clear that sin does separate us from a holy God. However, the Bible also reveals a God who makes himself known through suffering. Because of the suffering of Jesus on the cross, we can know God. And it's often through our own experience of suffering that we come to know God. Suffering is not just reserved for the wicked alone. Therefore, there's a good chance that we will experience suffering. Now, we don't need to seek suffering out for suffering's sake, but I do believe that suffering will seek us out and will find us. How? Why? The reasons? Suffering will find each of us because we are fallen people. Because we're flawed, there are times when we will make wrong choices which will create certain consequences. You know, if you commit murder then and you get caught, you're going to go to prison for murder. And all of us have done things and said things that have not been good or not been helpful or holy. And they've had an impact on our own lives and those around us. We never sin in isolation. Certainly, I've done and said many things that have not been helpful over the years, even as a Christian. But I did many things before as a Christian, which had certain knock-on effects, consequences to me living my life later. As a young 19-year-old, I was banned from driving for a year. And the consequence of that was that I had to give my car to my mum, which she was quite happy about. But the consequence knocking on from that a year later when I got my license back was that I couldn't afford the insurance. For a young man in his 20s now, as soon as I mentioned I've been banned and you had to tell him for 11 years, the insurance went up from £300 to £1,200. It was crazy. And I remember a Christian friend saying to me once, why don't you say to the insurance company that you've become a Christian? And I thought he was joking at first, but I thought, well, I might as well give it a go. So the next time I rang up the insurance company, said I'd like to get insurance, third party. By the way, I've been banned. And I go, oh, that goes 300 to 1200. And I said, well, I've also become a Christian. And I remember there was a silence on the other end of the phone. And then he said, and yes, what does that mean? And I says, well, that means hopefully I'm not going to do silly things again. And their response was, that's still £1,200. You see, there are consequences to our actions. As fallen people, our genetic code is fallen, making us susceptible to disease and illness. The pandemic has made that really obvious, how weak and how vulnerable we really are to things in this world. The whole world in which we live in is calling out. Do you know, I'm part of a very unique club. Only 1% of men in the whole of the world are in this club. Many of you will know that Kate and I are not able to have children, but you may not know that the reason we cannot have children is because there's something within my DNA, a genetic thing, that stops me basically from producing sperm. It is a genetic thing. It's within my DNA, and there's nothing that they can do. Well, that's what they told us 23 years ago. It may well have changed now because of technology. But I'm part of this incredible small club because my body has fallen, is broken. So suffering will find us out because we're fallen people. Secondly, suffering will find us out because we live in a fallen world. Because we live in a fallen world, we can experience suffering due to the poor decisions and choices made by others. Accidents, acts of violence, greed, lust, corruption. It may not be anything to do with us, but we're on the end of someone else's choices, someone else's actions, and it affects us. And it can be right from government systems right through to personal abuse in families and relationships. Suffering will find us because we live in a fallen world. Thirdly, suffering will find us because we are Christians. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus told us we would be persecuted in this world. This is what he said in Matthew 5:11. He said, blessed are you when people insult you, when they persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. As we obey him, we will experience negative consequences from those who do not follow him. You know, there are more people who are persecuted today for being Christians around the world than ever before. More people being put in prison. More people losing their homes, their jobs, even losing their lives because of Jesus. Fourthly, suffering will find us because we have an enemy that hates us. Satan is real and his desire is to create as much pain and suffering in the world as possible. Now, the story of Job, but it's seen by some commentators, is not actually being a real story, as it were. It is a story. It's a story made up, a little bit like some commentators believe that Jonah And the big fish was not real. It's just a story that God and God's people use to help people understand who God is and what he's like and the world in which we live. Now, that may be the case, it may not be. But Satan is real, for sure. And his desire is to create as much pain and suffering in the world as possible. 1 Peter 5 verse 8 says this, "Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour." In Ephesians 6 verse 12, Paul reminds us that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. You think of some of the things that have happened. You know, when you think of things like the Holocaust, or you think about some of the genocide that's happened around the world, it amazes me how so many people can be involved in these things. And we know that it was the strong use of propaganda, of lies. But we also know that we have an enemy who is the father of lies. And there's a demonic spirit behind many of these things that pushes and allows these things to build and to escalate. It's demonic. So we suffer because we have an enemy that hates us. Fifthly, suffering will find us because it is God's plan for us. Or maybe it's God's plan for us. How can I say that? You say, well, you can't be serious. Listen to what Job says. Job has been having these conversations with his friends, backwards and forwards. And all he says is, God, where are you? I want to talk to you. I want to see you. I want to meet with you. You know, I go to the north and you're not there. I go to the south and you're not there. I go to the west and the east and I can't find you. All I want to do is sit before you and talk to you and ask you what's going on. And then in verse 10 of 23, he says this. He knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. As a response to his friends, accusing him of doing all kinds of things, some heinous crimes, he says, no, God knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. The Apostle Paul would say amen to this statement. Why? Because Paul implies a number of benefits to suffering in the New Testament. He says it creates reliance upon God. Suffering can be a call to trust God and not the things of this world. In 2 Corinthians 1, 8 to 9, he says this to the believers. He writes, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles we experience in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt we'd received the sentence of death, but this happened that we might not rely on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." When we suffer, we throw ourselves on God. Secondly, righteousness. Suffering can be the discipline of a loving heavenly Father. In Hebrews 12, verse 6, 10, and 11, we read this. "The Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as his son. They disciplined us for a while as they thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, in order that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it." Suffering can be the discipline of a loving heavenly Father. Thirdly, it can be seen as reward. Suffering can be for us a great reward in heaven. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17, Paul says, "For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all." And fourthly, Paul says suffering can be a reminder. In Philippians 3, verse 10, He made this proclamation: I want to know Christ, yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. Suffering can be for us a reminder that God sent his son into the world to suffer so that our suffering would not be God's condemnation, but his purification. Suffering is real. Suffering, I believe, is a guaranteed aspect of living in this world, especially as a follower of Jesus. Now, most of us try our best to avoid suffering at all costs, and I include myself in that. I'm probably worse than most. I don't like suffering. I don't like suffering in my own life, and I don't like seeing it in others. I try and avoid it. One of the most difficult things that I've personally ever had to go through is having to see my mother at a young age, I suffer with a brain aneurysm, which left her in a vegetative state. And for almost 5 years, going to visit her in a home which looked after her. And for the first 5 years, first of those 5 years, going weekly and crying out to God in prayer that God would heal her. Talking to her daily, reading to her, playing her songs, and not getting not one word back. That first year, praying that God would intervene, that he would heal. And then the next 4 years, praying that God would take her home to glory. There are times when I went, after driving 45 minutes, I'd walk into her room, look at her and say, I love you, Mum, but I can't do this today. And I'd walk out again, literally within 1 minute, because I couldn't face what was before me. I tried to avoid as best I can. But it's still there. It doesn't go away. Last week, I encouraged you in the midst of suffering to respond in three ways. Be honest, be grateful, and be hopeful. If suffering is a guaranteed aspect of living in this world, then this week, I want to encourage you to do two further things. Expect it and embrace it. Hearing this is not comfortable, but hear me out. Expect it. Just knowing that each of us will experience suffering at some level or other should help us not to be shocked or overwhelmed by it when it does show up. One of the things that Job's story clearly demonstrates is that suffering is not a sign of God's absence and is not always a sign of our poor decision-making. So we need to expect it, if it's part and parcel of traveling through this world. And secondly, excuse me, embrace it. God can work through suffering and brokenness. We can encounter God in the midst of our suffering. God draws near to the broken-hearted. We try and avoid it. But maybe we need to embrace it. Maybe we need to sit down with it. Maybe we need to welcome it to our dinner table. Paul tells us in Romans 8:28 that we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. He works for the good of those who love him. in all things. Not just some things, not just the nice things, but even the painful things. Even, I believe, suffering. There are a number of reasons why people experience suffering today. We know that God allows it, and Job's story tells us we cannot even rule out that God may even send it our way. That's his plan. Maybe today, whatever you are going through, God can use your suffering to bring you closer to him. Maybe today, God can use your suffering to teach you total dependence, patience, and perseverance. Maybe today, God can use your suffering to comfort others. Or maybe today, God can use your suffering as a witness to others. Whatever, I encourage you to expect it and embrace it.